Welcome back to StackTrace, a show where we talk about Apple news from a developer's perspective. And as always, I'm Guy Rambo, and I'm joined by John Sandel.
Hello, hello. How's it going, Guy?
I'm going great. How's your week?
Oh, it's really, really good. I've been wrapping things up now with my syntax highlighter. And I know that I'm sounding probably like a little bit of a broken record because I've been talking about this syntax highlighter now for a long time. But I'm really excited about it because it's one of these things that I kind of didn't think that I could ever do realistically without like spending a lot of time on it. And it might seem like I've spent a lot of time on it because I've talked about it on the show now a few times, but it's just been one of these hobby projects that I've just been working a few hours here, a few hours there, and now it's almost done. Now I can generate a very nice image or HTML with the colored text, like with highlighted code for even a really complex file. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, and I helped you with testing by sending you a Swift file from hell.
Exactly. I told Rambo that, please send me the worst Swift file that you can ever think of. And I got one, and it's still a few things to work out here and there, but hopefully I will be able to open source this syntax highlighter this week. So that's my goal. That's what I'm working towards right now.
It was funny because you told me, send me some Swift code, and I was working on Chibi Studio, and I had Xcode open. And I happened to be working on an old file from like the first week of the project or something. So It wasn't particularly a good code. And I just dropped the entire file in the iMessage window.
Yeah, it was perfect.
It handled it pretty well, actually.
Yeah, it generated like a huge image that we just sent a little bit back and forth to work out all the edge cases. But yeah, things are looking pretty good. So I'm really excited to share this with more people and see what people think about it. And also, I want to say that I'm planning on our next after show to do a little bit of a demo and a little bit of a deep dive into this as well, like how I designed it and what goes into syntax highlighting and tokenizing and things like that, because I've learned a lot from doing this. And I think it's a pretty interesting thing as well. So look forward to that for our after show subscribers.
Yeah, I know you've been also doing some upgrades of apps to the latest iOS stack, so Swift 4.2 and iOS 12. How's that going for you?
Yeah, it's going really well as well. As people might know, I work as a freelancer, and so I work on a few different apps, and all of them now, they need updates to iOS 12 and the latest version of Swift, and some apps are easier to migrate than others. Some, you know, have a lot of API changes and things like that, but it's going really well. So I think I'm in the same boat as a lot of iOS developers out there, you know, migrating their code and adopting all the new SDKs and things like that. How's that going for you? Are you on iOS 12 yet, or are you still working on that?
Well, for Chibi Studio, of course, it's doing great. I'm working on Xcode 10 full-time for Chibi Studio because it's version 2.0 and it's going to support iOS 11 and later. And I'm already working on it with Swift 4.2 since the first beta of Xcode 10. So that's going very well.
Nice.
With my day job, not so much. I did like an Xcode 10 branch with the second beta of Xcode 10, and it would crash on launch with a Mac VM something cannot allocate memory error.
Those are just the worst.
Yeah, and then I basically left it, and I tried it again with, I think it was like beta 5, and still the same thing, because you always hope that it's something with the SDK or the tooling or a dependency that's going to be magically fixed with time.
Exactly.
But it's looking like it's not the case, and I'm going to have to do some digging there to see what's going on. So yeah, not so good there. This is something we should tell our non-technical audience if they're still here.
The two people.
Yeah, there's a difference between you having an iOS app that's built with the iOS 11 SDK. So the software development kit that you use is the iOS 11 one. And you run that app on iOS 12, but it's not going to behave the same way as if it was built with the iOS 12 SDK. So when you build against a newer SDK, the behavior of things changes slightly, or in some cases dramatically. So that's why you can have like an app that's been built with a previous SDK that still works fine, and then you build it against the new SDK and it all goes to hell. It stops working.
Yeah, and Apple also are usually using the SDK version for a lot of internal checks. Like, for example, when the bigger iPhones started coming out and you had to create more kind of dynamic launch screens and dynamic UI, they used the SDK version to determine whether or not you needed to adopt that or if you could run in like a legacy mode.
Yeah, so that's good because it keeps the expectations of the developer in mind. So I built this app with the iOS 10 SDK, let's say. I want it to behave like it did on iOS 10 as much as possible, and they try to preserve that. So it breaks doesn't break the apps as much when you get a new iOS version, and not necessarily all apps are going to get updated on day one.
Yeah, exactly. What's your current strategy for when you are migrating an app to a new SDK or a new version of iOS? Do you usually like use a new branch and then you continuously kind of merge the master branch into that branch? Or how do you usually deal with these things?
Well, in the case of Chibi Studio, we are not releasing new versions during this beta period of iOS 12. We did the version 1.9.9 a couple of months ago, and I've been working on the 2.0 and iOS 12 version since then. So there's no problem with going back to the previous version to release a bug fix or something.
Nice.
But yeah, it is a separate branch anyway. So it's all isolated from the main app, let's say. And then when it finally ships, hopefully, on day one with iOS 12, then it's getting merged into master, and that's it. And
right.
We're supporting iOS 11 and 12. It's still a side project, even though it generates income. It's not my day job, and I don't want to be supporting too much legacy. So I decided to support the current iOS version minus one.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very common strategy. It's kind of getting a little bit tricky sometimes to convince people to drop earlier versions because it's getting easier and easier to maintain backwards compatibility. For example, when we went from like iOS 6 to iOS 7, for example, it was really tricky to maintain iOS 6 compatibility because of the huge design changes, right? And the same thing for like pretty big leaps, like for example, 7 to 8 was also pretty big and things like that. But now, depending of course of which APIs you use and you know, if you use Core ML or some of these newer technologies, then it's a whole different game. But if you were using kind of normal UIKit controls, you know, you have lists and table views and collection views and things like that. Usually it's easier these days to support, you know, older versions. But I also try to convince most of my clients to stick with the current minus one, just because, you know, it just eliminates a whole kind of column from the testing matrix, you know, because every time you support another version of iOS, you have to also test all the different features for that version in order to be, you know, confident in a release. So it really makes testing so much easier to minimize that deployment target, or maximize it rather.
Yeah, and it's many times it's an economical decision. In the case of Chibi Studio, I did some queries with the analytics and how much income is iOS 10 generating in the last 90 days. Not enough to even pay for the time it would take to keep supporting iOS 10. So it's right. A no-brainer.
Yeah, absolutely. That's usually a good way of looking at it. You know, how much work are you putting in versus how much reward are you getting back? So besides migrations and working on Chibi Studio, I hear that you've been doing some shortcuts for Stacktrace.
Yeah, it's interesting because the shortcut is just the front-facing thing, but I did quite a cool project, which I had no idea how I would approach when it first started. We decided that we wanted some stats for the Stacktrace podcast because we use a provider that has very basic analytics, and we needed something more specific, like the number of downloads per episode and maybe some stats based on which client is being used, if it's Apple Podcasts or Overcast.
Mostly because we're huge data nerds, right? And we really love looking at graphs and these kind of things.
Yeah, and it's nothing like creepy, like the, I don't know, the name of the user, because we can't even get that, but it's basically like which clients are being used and how much each episode is being downloaded, maybe the geolocation based on the IP, which is not very precise, but just to get an idea of where our audience is and how much traction each episode is getting. So basic stats that we need and we wanted to get because we are nerds. And we thought about it. Well, actually, I thought about it. I decided to try and doing something different with Cloudflare workers.
Yeah, you were basically like using the CDN as kind of middleware, right? Where everything, all the requests, they pass through the CDN. So you're using that as the kind of point to inject some code to run some logic, right?
Yeah, so the workers, they are basically middleware that you write in JavaScript.
Your favorite language.
Yep. Yeah. No, not really. But hey, the worker stuff is cool, so I can bear the pain of writing some JavaScript.
The end justifies the means, right?
Yeah, so basically every time there's a feed request, so some app downloads the feed, it registers with a subsystem, that download of the feed, and same happens for episodes, and it just gathers some basic metadata that can be gathered from like the user agent or something for the podcast client. And that's it. So, and it aggregates that data, and we have an internal API that we can use that gives us the number of downloads per episode and other stuff as well, like the number of feed requests per client and the number of episode downloads per client as well. So if it was Overcast or Apple Podcasts. And it was actually quite easy to make, a little tricky because that's not where I'm usually working. So it's a little bit out of my programming comfort zone. Uh-huh. But it was really cool and it's really nice. And so then I made a Siri shortcut that tells us the number of downloads of the latest episode. And I'll probably make some others as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love those kind of projects. It's very similar to why I'm working so much on the Syntax Highlighter, because you are producing something and you are kind of proving to yourself that you can do it, but you're also learning so much along the way, right? And like you say, you're stepping out of your comfort zone, you're experimenting, you're reading up on things, and you're, yeah, learning a lot. And when you finally get there, you can actually produce something that works. It's just so satisfying, right? And for me, those are like the absolutely best kind of hobby projects, when you can combine learning with having fun, with sharing something with the community maybe, and yeah, just experimenting and having a good time.
Yeah, and this is the only way I can actually learn stuff. This is how I learned basically everything I know. It's by having a project that I want to do, something that I want to achieve, and actually going through the learning required to get to my goal. And then many times you end up learning, oh, maybe I could stretch my goal and do something else as well, because I could do this and that. So it's a good strategy. If you are trying to learn something in this area, maybe think of something you want and go ahead and learn what you need to learn to make that happen.
Yeah, and a lot of times it can seem in the beginning when you're looking at a problem like it will be very, very complicated, it will take a long time to learn, but once you start kind of splitting things up and you start learning the basics of what it is you need to do, for example, you know, web workers and using a CDN and these kind of things that you've been exploring, you know, once you learn the basic building blocks, it's so much easier to continue, right? And then you just learn more and you can build more and you can build more and more sophisticated things, and it's really motivating.
Yeah, and I think we're going to talk more about this during the Ask Stack Trace part, because we have a question that has something to do with it.
Definitely. All right, but we should get to the news. We have some new rumors about new Mac computers. And it's again our good friend Mark Gurman, who's been at it again. Tell us, Rambo, about the new rumors. What is this all about?
So apparently I'm rolling my eyes, not because I don't think it's true, but because of the terms used again. A new low-cost MacBook.
Right.
Because every year there are tons of low-cost Apple something on everywhere, but I'm guessing this means like an entry-level MacBook, which would be a replacement to the MacBook Air, and it would feature thinner bezels around the screen. That's cool. I would like that.
Yeah.
So it would have a Retina display, and the MacBook Air would cease to exist.
Yeah, exactly. So the MacBook Air has had a very long reign. It's been in service now for a very long time. I think it was originally introduced in 2008, right? So it's like the 10-year anniversary now of the MacBook Air. Of course, they've tweaked the design a little bit. They have bumped the specs and all that stuff. But it's pretty much the same kind of product since it was launched, which is pretty cool and interesting. And it's also kind of a testament to just how popular this computer is.
I remember the launch of the MacBook Air like it was yesterday, because it was really iconic.
Yeah.
Steve taking the laptop out of an envelope, and you could hear the audience gasp, and it was really, really cool. We're going to leave a link in the show notes to the video.
This is the new MacBook Air, and you can get a feel for how thin it is. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah, it's one of Steve Jobs' better moments on stage, I think. It's such a magical moment when he does that. It's still to this day, like, even though we have so thin computers now, like almost everyone who uses like a MacBook Pro or something like that, or an iPad is even thinner, you know, it's even though we have all these thin devices now, it's still so impressive to see that, right? Because it's not only the fact that they managed to build such a thin computer like 10 years ago, it's also, like Steve did best, it's like the showmanship of it, right? Like pulling it out of an envelope and all this stuff. It's like, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, the grand reveal. I think that was one of his best keynotes.
Definitely.
And then we have a rumor about a new Mac Mini.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Mac Mini is still a product in their product line.
Yeah. So what do you think about the new Mac Mini rumors? There's the rumor that it's going to be more pro-focused this time. So not so much focused as being the entry-level product, but rather maybe more as a pro machine. What do you think about that, Rambo?
I think that would be a good strategy. I don't think that if it's too expensive, it's going to be very good, because many people use the Mac Mini as a quote-unquote cheap Mac. So maybe they should keep a lower cost version, which I really hope wouldn't be the current generation, because it's really old. So I would be sad if they released only more expensive models and not like at least one baseline model that has the same cost as the current one.
Yeah.
But I think that the focus on pros makes a lot of sense, because, John, I want to hear your experience, but on my experience, I've seen Mac Minis being used the most as three things. Either a media server, like a set-top box kind of thing, or just like a home media server or another type of server. As a server on the cloud, something like Mac Stadium, so other services like that, where you can co-locate a Mac Mini or rent a Mac Mini. Mm-hmm. I have one, in fact. And then the other use is for like CI, either on-site CI or like in the cloud as well. So, and those are all, you can call them all pro workflows.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though running a media center, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make you like a professional, like, you know, you're not doing maybe doing serious work necessarily with that, but it's still like a power user feature, right? Yeah. Most people who just want a computer for like, I mean, the classic thing people say is like, yeah, email, web browsing, watching YouTube, these kind of things, don't usually set up their own media center. So that's more like a power user thing. And that's why I also think that it makes a ton of sense, actually, to see this as a more like a pro machine. And especially if you really make it so, like you really build in features into it that really lend themselves to this use case. Because I agree with you, those three use cases you mentioned, running continuous integration, which basically to explain to our good friends who are not developers, is basically when you want to run certain builds and tests and these kind of things on your code, but not on your local machine. Like you want to do it in the cloud somewhere or on some other machine, and you want to automate certain workflows and things like that. So a media server, continuous integration, and running it as a server, I agree. I think those are the, you know, most common use cases from what I see as well. And if Apple could build features that really are geared towards those use cases, I think that could be really powerful. For example, let's say it's much smaller and much easier to like stack or chain them together. That would make them much, much better to use in a kind of a server environment, because you might want to string many of them together and things like that without having to, you know, build specific racks and things like that. You know, features like that could really make this a really cool pro machine for things like automation.
Yeah, and if you're running it on a server environment, there are also thermal considerations that are important to be made.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. And if you think about the entry-level market for a Mac Mini computer, it doesn't really exist anymore for like doing, let's say, what's the most cliche entry-level work, like text processing for school or something.
Yeah.
People don't use desktop computers for that anymore. People use laptops
and tablets and iPads, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So the market for that is not there anymore.
Exactly. And this is why I totally also think that Apple, they're not looking at this anymore as a cheap Mac, right? They're not looking at it as a way to get an entry-level Mac into your house. It used to be that way. But number one, a lot of people who used to buy those kind of things now buy just a phone or a tablet or an iPad, you know, something like that, or a laptop. And what do we have left? Well, we have left all the developers who want to automate their things, and they're buying Mac Minis because apparently it's the fastest computer that can compile Swift code, right? Do you remember that? There were some tests like a while back that because of the way the Swift compiler is designed and because the Mac Mini still had the like fastest single-threaded performance, at least at some point ago, it was the fastest computer to compile Swift code on, which is kind of hilarious. But these kind of computers are awesome for these kind of automation work because they're easier to deploy, they're smaller, they're headless. You know, if we can get some nice customization maybe with them, that would be even better. You could maybe, you know, put in some custom GPUs and things like that. Then the possibilities really, really grow, and you can start seeing these really pro use cases with this kind of computer.
Yeah, you mentioned GPUs, and another use case these days is machine learning models, training for machine learning. And I guess you could probably be using something on Amazon or something to do that. But if you need a Mac for any specific reason, maybe you need to convert it to CoreML and test it right away on the same machine. I don't know. So there are other uses as well. The only reason I mentioned I'd like for there to be a Mac of this configuration that's accessible in price is because of the markets where I'm inserted, which is the Brazilian market. And I know this is true for lots of countries where getting started as an Apple developer, which is usually an iOS developer, there's a barrier to entry, which is the price, because you have to use a Mac, and Macs are extremely expensive. And I feel like it's easier in terms of like taxes and stuff for them to get the Mac Mini, something in the form factor of a Mac Mini, to a lower cost then it would be to release like a low cost MacBook or something in this market. One question which I get frequently is how do I get into iOS development if I don't have a Mac? And it's usually from Brazilians that I get the question. And it's sad because the person wants to work with something and they can't because they can't afford the machine.
Yeah. And we're seeing some things that could, you know, be a solution to this problem. Like, for example, there are some services now where you can run Swift in the browser, for example, or you could use Swift Playgrounds on an iPad. But it's not really iOS development, right? Like, you can learn the language, you can learn Swift if that's what you want to do, but you can't really build an app yet. And hopefully we'll see something like this in the next couple of years, like some version of Xcode running on the iPad. But until then, yeah, the barrier for entry is very high. And I mean, it's not only for developing markets and things like that. It's also, you know, it's probably one of my biggest expenses, right, is buying Apple hardware. And of course, part of that is self-inflicted because, you know, I want to have all the cool stuff and I love Apple stuff. But it's also like a necessity, right? Like, you, as an iOS developer, you kind of need to have the latest phone to test on. At least that's what we tell ourselves, right? but you also like need to upgrade your computer and these kind of things. And yeah, it would be cool if it wasn't always the case that you needed to buy the most fancy computer in order to do your development work. It would be cool if there was a more low-cost option as well.
Yeah, you mentioned spending money on Apple hardware. There was a news piece yesterday we were sharing around at the office about a girlfriend that was mad and she dumped all of her boyfriend's Apple devices into the toilet or something. And my colleague mentioned, oh, if it were your girlfriend, she would need an Olympic-sized swimming pool or something. yeah. Olympic pool full of iOS devices.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a nice swim to go for. Just a history museum of all the different Apple products floating by as you're swimming.
Underwater Apple Museum. That exactly. Would be really cool. There's a market for that.
Definitely. Let's move on and talk a little bit about what we think Apple might be doing in the fall, which is approaching really quickly. It's still like almost 30 degrees here where I live in Krakow in Poland, but, you know, fall is coming quicker than we think. But before we do, let's take a very quick break and talk a little bit about our Patreon, because we're super excited that we've had a lot of new people joining us on our Patreon, which we are very, very excited about and thankful for. And we've now reached a pretty big milestone. We are now over one third towards our weekly episode goal. So we've now gathered 33% of the people and the support that we need in order to be able to do this show every week. And we really couldn't be more excited about this, right, Rambo? Like, being able to do this show every week, that's our dream.
Yeah, I couldn't be more excited. We got some new patrons. We noticed that there was an influx recently, and I'm very happy for that. And people joining today already get access to quite some content, right?
Yeah, we're thinking about more and more content that we can, you know, put on our Patreon without it becoming like a paywall. We don't want it to be like that. We want it to be, you know, extra nice content for all the people who really like the show, who wants to see it succeed, who wants more that we can produce. So we're doing our after show, which is our monthly live hangout. And we're thinking about more things that we could do there as well. Maybe some videos, maybe some special small clips and things from the show. We'll see what we come up with. And if you have any ideas, then feel free to tell us as well. But we really want to thank our good friends of the show, which is Harsh Dubai, Brandon Sellers, Ken Barlow, Igor Ferreira, and Nopali. These are the people supporting us for more than $30 per month, which we really, really appreciate. But you can support us with anything that you can or want. And it starts just from $1. For $5, you get access to the after show, which we think is a pretty good deal. And we see a lot of people excited about that. So we're very, very happy for that. And to find out more, just go to our Patreon page. It's patreon.com/stacktracepod. And again, if you have any suggestions how we can improve, or you just want to support the show, just let us know, and we'll see where it goes. We're excited now to reach 50%.
Yeah, and we now have stats.
Exactly. Stats are the best. All right. So what do we think that Apple will do now in the fall? We've already talked about some glyphs that you found on the last episode for things like new iPads that might be coming and new different screen sizes for iPhone. But we've also now seen that Apple, they've been registering some new device identifiers and some new device types for new versions of the Apple Watch. So what's that all about, Rambo?
Yeah, so as always, when the dates for a new event approaches, we get some glimpses into what Apple is working on. Last year, we got the leaked iPhone X and lots of other things from the HomePod firmware. This year, iOS 12, the beta itself, is revealing lots of things, including the iPad with thinner bezels and no home button and no notch as well, and Face ID on the iPad and stuff. So there are new Apple Watch devices that have been registered, and that's also not necessarily news, because I found some identifiers on iOS 12, which later got removed for reasons.
Retracted.
Yeah, so they mentioned Apple Watch 4 models, so that would be the Series 4. And yeah, so new Apple Watches are definitely coming. So we can expect a very busy fall for Apple hardware. We are going to get 3 new iPhones, a new Apple Watch model, possibly 2 new iPads, new Mac Mini, and a new MacBook. So what are we guessing in terms of, without going into too much poker, because it's not the poker episode,
yeah,
but in terms of how they divide the events, because I'm pretty sure we're going to get an event in September, probably on the September 12th or maybe the following week, and another one in October. That's very common for Apple to do.
Yeah.
And if I had to guess, I would say we are going to get the new iPhones and Apple Watch during the September event, and the new iPad Pros and Macs in the October event.
Yeah, that makes total sense, because then you have kind of a consumer event in September, and then a kind of prosumer or pro event in October, right? So you take the iPhone, which is obviously the most mainstream device and that they kind of need to show in September. I can only imagine what's going to happen to their stock price if they don't show an iPhone in September.
Wow. You know,
those $1 trillion, they're going to disappear very, very quickly. So that for sure, I mean, it's pretty much a given. And bundling that with Apple Watch makes total sense. That's what they've been doing for a couple of years now. And, you know, they're running versions of the same operating system. You know, everything kind of makes sense. Then saving the Mac and the iPad Pros for a specific event will also, I think, make a lot of sense. And I'm also thinking that, do you think that Apple might show a little bit more of Marzipan? Like, show a little bit more of their strategy? Maybe now they've had a couple of more months to work on it, and now show it more in kind of a more, I don't know, user kind of context rather than a developer context. What do you think about that?
These events, they are always events focused on hardware, but there is precedent for cool new software stuff to be shown as well. And one thing I forgot to mention during my description of what would be the September event is HomePod. They
right.
are probably going to dedicate an entire section of the event to what's coming to HomePod with iOS 12. We know that we are going to get the ability to make phone calls, and also we are going to be getting the multiple timers that have been asked for a long time. And I think that's by itself deserves a mention during the event. But there's probably more stuff which we don't know about, and they are probably going to talk about AirPower as well. So I think
that's
a full event. Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. If they don't talk about AirPower, then they're going to fall below the 1 trillion.
Right. Yeah. That's what Wall Street is waiting for, is the AirPower, right?
They are waiting on AirPower. So, yeah, I think, if you think about, 3 new iPhones, you think about new Apple Watch and new HomePod features plus AirPower, that's an entire event in there.
Yeah, absolutely. One thing I want to say just as a kind of a quick aside on HomePod is that, you know, when HomePod came out, there was a kind of a lot of criticism about it, that it was very limited and it didn't do so much, you know, in terms of supporting third-party services like Spotify and things like that. But I've been thinking a lot about HomePod lately. Like, I don't have one, and right now there's no real big incentive for me to buy one. But I must say that I've come around a little bit to the thinking around HomePod and the strategy around it, because what did they do really, if we think about it? They focused 100% pretty much on the hardware, right? Like, really getting the hardware really good, like really good audio, really good hardware, you know, really good design, all those kind of things. And then the rest is just software, right? So when you have this really good hardware platform and you have a flexible software platform, what can you do? Well, you can just keep building software, right? And that's why I'm personally thinking that the strategy around HomePod might not be to release like a new device every year, like here's HomePod 2, HomePod 3, but more like HomePod as a service, right? Where you have the HomePod and it just gets continuously updated and it just gains capabilities because the hardware is already so good that they can just keep building on top of it with software. What do you think about that, Rambo?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I remember, I think we were chatting over at the 9to5 Mac Slack about before the 11.4 update came out for HomePod, that, oh, maybe we shouldn't buy multiple HomePods based on the promise that we are going to get stereo and AirPlay 2 and stuff. There was a discussion on one of the shows that Vitici is on as well. I remember he talking about purchasing the device based on what it could be in the future because of software.
Yeah.
But I think for people who did purchase the HomePod thinking about the feature, it paid off because it's been getting new features with pretty much every minor OS update. Not patches, not like the .1, but like the 11.4 got some new features, and 12 is definitely bringing in new features. And we were talking about the stack trace shortcuts, the number of downloads, and it works from HomePod. It's still a little bit buggy because it says after it does the shortcut and tells you the result, it says, sorry, I couldn't do that, even though it did. So that's a little bug in there because, and it's a known bug. It's in the release notes for iOS 12.
Yeah, they're probably nil checking the NS error in some weird way, right?
Yeah, so it knows nothing about shortcuts, but it works. It's a little buggy, but it works. And when iOS 12 comes out, it's going to be even better. So I think HomePod as a service thing actually makes sense, and it's getting better with each software release. And I use it to listen to music, and I use it quite a bit with my Apple TV as audio for my Apple TV because my setup favors that. It's I have two HomePods, one on either side of the TV, and it sounds amazing and works flawlessly in terms of the connection and stuff. I never had any issues. I've had some issues before AirPlay 2 where AirPlaying from iPhone would drop sometimes, but I'm also always running betas, so I can't really complain too much.
Right.
And I filed some radars, and they've all been fixed. So they are really focusing on the software for HomePod.
Yeah, and that's why this device is so fascinating to me, even though, like I mentioned, I don't really have a desire to buy one. I just the only reason I would buy one is just to study it, right? Because it's just fascinating because it's this, you know, headless device. It doesn't have any ports even. It's just like, it's a thing that can just do audio really, really well. And then it's just powered by all these other devices and it's very dynamic. And this for me just is like a really beautiful thing, like technically. And, you know, I've been talking before on the show about my dream where I would just have one device and I will walk around and it can connect to anything and I can connect to any screen and all the terminals are kind of these quote unquote dumb terminals and it's just like one device that powers them. And I think this as a kind of, you know, end goal or ideal kind of version of technology is like, it's something that really appeals to me, and HomePod seems to be really along those lines.
Yeah, I'm really happy with HomePod, and I must say, if you did get one for studying, you would probably fall in love with it.
Probably.
Because it happened to me, like, I got one thinking like, I'm just going to test this. I write about Apple, and I research Apple, and I am an Apple developer. I don't have any audio products, but let me test this and see how it goes. And then all of a sudden I have two of them, and yeah. I've been thinking about getting a third. So yeah, there you go.
It almost sounds like I'm like going to study wildlife, right? Look at the HomePod in its natural habitat. Oh, all right. So yeah, exciting fall coming up. We're obviously going to do our poker episode and speculate more in detail. Before we leave this topic, I just wanted to quickly return to what I said earlier, where the reason I asked you about Marzipan in particular was I'm thinking that if they're going to bundle both the iPads and the Macs in the same kind of event, that it might make sense to start telling more the story of how these devices work together, right? And it might be something like, oh, we gave early access to this company and they built this service where you can now run it on the iPad and you can run it on the Mac and it all just works, something like that. We've seen, for example, Microsoft do a lot of these demos in the past where they are, you know, showing some business cases of how these different devices can talk to each other and things like that. And yeah, that was just my thinking around that.
First of all, I'm sorry that I completely ignored your Marzipan question, which is interesting. I agree with you. I think we might see something like that. And I think it would be kind of cool if they had some really mainstream thing, like, let's say, Snapchat is coming to the Mac, and they do like a demo of Snapchat running on the new MacBook with a true depth camera system,
running
Marzipanified on the Mac. That would be really cool, and I think we might see something like that. But let's leave that for the poker.
Yeah, exactly. It's probably a little bit early, but you know, one can dream, right?
Yeah,
dream about Marzipan.
Well, there's porting an iOS app to the Mac with Marzipan, even without the SDK, the official SDK, is not that hard, depending on what your app is doing. So I guess if a company like Snapchat had help from Apple and had like a couple of weeks, they could definitely build something that could be demoed. Not like a finished product, but something that could be a demo that they would then go on and work until next year, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so lots of things to look forward to. One thing to not so much look forward to is using third-party apps on Twitter, right? And now we're going to enter the little bit depressing segment of the show here. We're going to play the sad music, you know, all those kind of things. I'm personally not using a third-party Twitter client. I know I'm very crazy, but that's kind of how I roll. But I know, Rambo, that you have been kind of upset about the recent shutdown of some APIs that third-party Twitter clients were using. So tell us a little bit about that for those people who haven't followed along the story. Like, what is the deal with third-party Twitter apps? Why are people leaving Twitter for things like Mastodon and Micro.blog? And what's going on?
Yeah, so the thing that happened is that most third-party Twitter apps were using an API, which was called the streaming API. So let's say you use Tweetbot, like myself. You like post a tweet, and you immediately start seeing activity for that tweet. So as people like your tweet and retweet and reply, you get that information immediately. It's like push notifications. It's basically, push notifications are basically streaming. So that's the ability that they are taking away from apps. And it happened last week. So the third-party clients updated themselves to reflect that change. And to be clear, it's not the fault of the third-party clients. It's Twitter basically saying they can't have that anymore. So Tweetbot and Twitterific updated their apps, and they don't have streaming anymore, which means my setup for Twitter and Tweetbot has always been I have three columns on Tweetbot. Well, it used to be this way. Three columns in Tweetbot as a separate space on my Mac. The leftmost column is my timeline. The middle one is mentions. And the rightmost one is activity. Mm-hmm. So the activity means like every time someone follows me or someone likes or retweets something, it appears in the activity. So that's how it used to be. And now basically I don't have the activity column anymore. And when I want to see if there are new mentions before the automatic refresh interval, which I think it's like 2 minutes, I have to pull to refresh, and you don't get that scrolling timeline where things just appear automatically.
Right.
So it's a pretty big blow to my workflow, and I know it's very bad for other people's workflows. Our most of the 9-to-5 Mac staff has been affected by it because they use Twitter as a means of being aware of things that are happening. So it's a bummer, and it's all Twitter's fault, and they did it because they apparently want to steer people away from third-party clients, even though they don't want to say it, which is the most infuriating part. But let's not get too much into that because I'm already upset.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of hard to figure out what their motivation is here. And of course, like, there can be many different factors playing into this. Like, they are talking about streamlining products and things like that. And I of course, there needs to be a little bit of a component like that regardless as well. I mean, if you have a public API to maintain, that's always more difficult than if you're just consuming it internally. But I'm sure there's a lot of different factors here at play, and they may not be telling the full story. We don't know. But it is kind of sad to see this happening, even though, like I mentioned, I am not a user of a third-party Twitter client, mostly because I think sometimes a lot of people think that I use Twitter more than I do because I do post quite a lot. Like I post like once or twice or something per day. And I try to reply to almost everyone who sends me something on Twitter, whether that's a mention or a DM or something like that. I try to, you know, stay as connected and answer people's questions and these kind of things. But I don't like have Twitter open constantly. Like for me, that would be a huge productivity killer. So I usually try to only check Twitter when I am not doing anything else, like when I'm taking a break or something like that.
You know something that's sad?
What's sad?
I have a muscle memory that I pretty much automatically, while Xcode is building, my fingers do the forefinger swipe on the trackpad to go to my Twitter space.
Right. You enter
because
your
the project
space.
I work on my day job, it takes a while to compile, so I do something while it's compiling, and it's usually Twitter.
Yeah, I know a lot of people who do that, and sometimes I do that as well, but I really see it for myself. I see it as a bad thing. Like, I don't want to do that. Because, for example, if I have a project that is taking too long to compile, I actually really want to fix that. Like, I think that is a big productivity killer. And I know some projects, there it's hard to fix because just of the, you know, huge magnitude of code that they have. But then I try to split things up, and I try to do different techniques because I really don't want to be distracted when I'm working. Like, one thing that I think I am pretty good at when it comes to productivity is just staying in the zone when I'm working and relaxing when I'm relaxing. So, you know, again, sometimes some people might get the impression that I work all the time because I work on a lot of different stuff. And I do work a lot, but whenever I work, I try to stay just as focused as I can because I really don't want to be in the state where I'm like semi-working. If I'm doing that, then I'd rather just not work and relax. And when I'm back working, I just focus 100% on that. So for me, again, this is not a huge problem, but still, I think it's kind of sad. And Twitter for me has always, like, the beauty of the platform. There's, of course, a lot of problems with the platform too, but the beauty has always been that it's like this, it feels, has always felt more open than some of the other social networks, and that you can use whichever client you want. You can use it in so many different ways. You can use it for your, you know, for communicating with your audience, or you can just use it for fun. You can use it to talk to your friends. There's so many different ways to use it. And for me, this move is a little bit a move away from that and a move more towards the kind of Facebook model where everything is a little bit more locked down. And that kind of makes me sad.
Yeah, and just to be clear, I don't want to sound like the people who complain about having to do in-app purchases in my app to get some features, because it can sound sometimes that we're just whining, and
yeah.
We are not realizing that Twitter needs this to be sustainable as a company. I totally understand that. I think there are better ways to deal with it. Like one issue with third-party apps is that they don't show ads. And I think it would be totally fine if Twitter changed their API terms of service to say that apps are required to show ads, and if they don't, they are going to be refused access to the API. I think that's totally fair. I wouldn't mind seeing the ads. Well, I wouldn't mind, actually, but I understand that they need that revenue to be sustainable as a company.
Yeah.
So I think there's a solution in there. They could also charge for some features. Like, I don't know how that would work technically, but I would happily pay like $10 a month for streaming on a third-party client. And that's because I know it's not the same for everyone, but for me, the Twitter app on iOS is very bad, and there's no Mac app. So there's not even an alternative on the Mac other than using the web. And I'm sure for someone like you, who uses Twitter more casually, even though you use it quite a bit, but you use it more casually than me, I know that the web is more than enough.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that the web experience is bad necessarily. I've used it sometimes because sometimes I needed to reply to polls and I wanted to do my own, and you can't do that in third-party clients. But I really need a native Mac app, and Twitter doesn't offer one. So, and now they have removed the ability of the other apps to be good, and they are saying that they were saying that it wasn't sustainable because it was a legacy API and this and that, but that's on them. Like, why haven't you rewritten this API in these many years? And I don't know, maybe you close the API, but leave it open. They also mentioned bots that use the API, apparently. But can't you just shut down those API keys and keep Tweetbot and Twitterific and, like, the, I don't know, leave just the top 10 Twitter apps in user count? I don't know. I think there are other solutions, and that they are just using all of this as an excuse to close down the platform.
Yeah, I mean, what's obvious that's kind of happening here, regardless of the in-depth, like, details around why this decision was made, is just that it's not a priority, right? Like, of course, they could have done all those things that you say. They could have, you know, really worked on the API. They could have refactored the technical platform it's built on. They could have fixed all these things and imposed better guidelines for ads and all those things. But it's just clearly not been a priority for a very long time. I mean, these APIs, I think, were deprecated like 5 years ago or something, right? So there's been this, the writing has been pretty clear on the wall that this has not been a priority for them. And again, we can argue whether that's good or bad. Even though I'm not using a third-party app, I think it's bad because I do like the flexibility of Twitter. And it's also pretty cool, I think, the thing that used to happen, which was, if you were learning how to build iOS apps, for example, a lot of people were building a Twitter client to learn, right? Because it was a great API. Like, back in the day, when the Twitter API was like at its high point and everyone was excited about it, it was a really good API and people were really using it to learn. And again, like, that's the benefit of such an open platform that Twitter used to be. And it's kind of just sad to see that gone, regardless of what I think about the kind of political situation or the priorities and things like that. Just the kind of end result I just wish that they would prioritize that, but I can also understand that there's so many forces going on within the company. Having worked in a big company myself also, it's very, very common for people on the outside to look at the big company and they go, they have all these people, they have all these resources, why don't they do X, Y, and Z? But then there's not only X, Y, and Z, there's also A, B, Z, and all the way up to X, Y, and Z. Yeah, there's so many different forces and priorities, and that's why I maybe I'm not as hard on Twitter as maybe a lot of other people, and maybe some people would argue that I should be, just because I can just kind of a little bit understand what's going on inside of the company, or try to imagine it and try to maybe have a little bit of empathy towards that. And, you know, there's surely reasons for these kind of decisions. And of course, like, the main criticism I think here is just that there's such a big lack of communication. If they would have just communicated this a little bit better, I'm sure everyone could more understand these decisions. But for now, you know, we're kind of left to speculate, and that usually leads to pretty nasty speculations, right?
Yeah, I agree. My main problem with this is the lack of an understanding, or at least an apparent understanding on the part of Twitter, that why people are so mad at them. And they seem to really don't know what's going on, like from official tweets by people on the Twitter team and even the CEO and the person responsible for their API. It really sounds like they don't really understand why people are so mad. And there was this funny situation where I think it was the person responsible for their API tweeted screenshots of an email he sent to employees about the change, I think. And he was using a third-party email client on iOS, so... And he was asking, like, oh, we want to understand why people hire third-party clients. Well, the same reason why you don't use mail.app.
Right, yeah. Yeah, it's just the flexibility that gets lost, and flexibility is usually a good thing because many different people have so many different workflows. So again, like, I'm not necessarily defending Twitter here, and there are so many things that are wrong with Twitter and that Twitter needs to improve. I can just kind of just try to imagine how it looks like under the hood of this company. I'm sure there's just chaos, right? There's so many different things going on and so many problems, and yeah, I guess they just need to try to sort all these things out.
Yeah, and just to finish off this section, the sad part of the episode, people can follow us on other social networks.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we're both on Mastodon and we're both on micro.blog. You've even done you did a week, you exiled yourself for 1 week to Mastodon from Twitter. What was that like, first of all?
Yeah, it was actually interesting. I kind of liked it. And I got more engagement on Mastodon than I was expecting to get, to be honest. It also wasn't a full week. It was like 5 days, I think, or maybe even less than that. But a few days off Twitter. Yeah, basically. And then I was mainly posting on Mastodon. And it was interesting to try out another social network. Mastodon tries to be kind of like Twitter, except that the name is horrible. I really don't like the name. And they are decentralized in the sense that you can run your own Mastodon instance, and you can choose whether your instance allows people to follow your users from other instances. The one that most people were going to was Mastodon.social.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that one is pretty open. You can follow people from any Mastodon instance that's public, I guess. But yeah, it was a cool experience. And there's an app that I'm using, which is called Tutdon. So yeah, the name of the app is worse than the name of the service. But you can use it, and it's nice. It kind of reminds me of Tweetbot. And they were having some server issues, understandably, because they were getting a huge influx of users, which was unexpected to them.
Yeah.
So, it's an interesting service, and I'll probably keep it around. So you can follow me there. We're going to leave the link in the show notes. Yeah. And we are also in micro.blog.
Yeah, we are. With micro.blog, for those who haven't used it, it's on the surface level, for me, it was kind of hard to understand, to be honest. Like, on the surface level, it looks like Twitter a little bit, but it also doesn't. So you're looking at it and you're like, is this a social network? Is this a blog? Is this an RSS reader? It's kind of a little bit of everything. So how it works...
Even a podcast app.
Yeah, kind of. So the way I use it is that I have connected it to my website. So I'm basically hosting my microblog on swiftbysundell.com. So all the posts you see are just RSS items, basically, from my website. And I also have stack trays in there as well. So you can see kind of all the RSS feeds that I work on, they end up on my micro.blog. And then you can comment on them, and then I get mentions, and I can reply to those mentions. So in that way, it's kind of like Twitter. The more I use it, and granted, I've used it very little. I've just had a few people kind of mention me there, and I've replied and things like that. But I'm warming up to it, I must say. For me, it's way more interesting than Mastodon, because Mastodon feels to me like a little bit just like a reaction to Twitter and say, like, Twitter is terrible, let's go build another Twitter over here. And I know that's not 100% true, it's not 100% fair description of Mastodon, but micro.blog for me has kind of gone from this, what is this weird thing, to, this is kind of interesting. So I'm staying on both of these things for now, as a kind of minimum effort kind of thing. I'm trying to reply to everybody who mentions me there and stuff like that. But I'm looking at it and it's interesting. I must say it's interesting.
Yeah, and I have micro.blog setup as it tweets anything I post there to my Twitter as a tweet. So I have a mirror to Twitter. And I will try to do some sort of setup. I'm not really sure how I'm going to do it yet, where I can post to the three services at the same time. So it's cool. It's kind of have a backup of my online content.
Yeah, absolutely. And for me, it's like, if I can be on these services without being a huge amount of work, if people prefer these other services, then why not? Like, why not enable people to read my content on micro.blog or on Mastodon? So for me, it's going to be a lot about just streamlining that to make sure I don't, you know, have to do three times the amount of work to post content. But other than that, you know, I'm happy to be a part of them. And again, it's interesting to follow along and to see how they evolve. To wrap up the show, we're going to do a brand new segment. And this segment is called Ask Stacktrace. So like we mentioned two shows ago, we're going to start doing this where if you want to ask us a question or provide some feedback or something like that, you can tweet with the hashtag AskStackTrace. And you don't have to mention us or StackTracePod or something like that. You can just tweet out into Twitter and we'll pick it up and we'll try to answer your question here on the show. And again, this is something we have shamelessly stolen from our good friends at the Upgrade Podcast, which is a great show. So go check that out. But we're just going to start doing that and see how it goes. So we should kick it off here with our first question that comes from Damodar Shenoy. What are the chances of macOS having Apple Watch apps as widgets, like the widgets that were available in macOS Tiger and earlier? So basically like the dashboard, right? So what do you think about this, Rambo? The macOS dashboard widgets that we had previously were basically like HTML snippets, right? They were like part of a website or something. But what about taking an Apple Watch app and running it on the Mac as a little widget? Do you think that would be cool?
Those are the tricky questions when they start with what are the chances, why, or when? Those are very tricky to answer.
Yeah.
So what are the chances? I'd say very close to zero. but on an infinite time scale
with unlimited resources.
Yeah. So there are some technical issues with that, not to mention that dashboard is going to die eventually. It still exists on the Mac, but it's disabled by default and they try to hide it from the users.
Yeah.
I must confess, I still use it and I use it as an overlay. I just opened it here. And I still use iStat on the dashboard. I know it's weird because you have that on the notification center now if you want. Yeah. But I'm just so used to it because I've been using Macs for 10 years and I've always used Dashboard in this way. I think that's the reason why they're keeping Dashboard alive while they can.
Uh-huh.
So there are some technical limitations, not to mention that the fact that the Dashboard is probably going to eventually die, and I don't think they're going to put any more effort into developing it further. With that said, with Marzipan, we are probably going to eventually, which means maybe even next year when they release the public API, maybe iOS apps that have Notification Center extensions will get their Notification Center extensions in the macOS Notification Center. So I think on iOS they are called the Today extensions.
Oh, right, yeah. The ones that, yes, like when you swipe to the left on the home screen or in the lock screen.
Or when you 3D touch the app icon. So right. I think we might get that on the Mac with Marzipan, which makes a lot of sense. And I don't think it would be too complicated to implement technically. So I think that's way, way, way more likely than Apple Watch apps.
Yeah. The widget metaphor in general for me is very interesting. Like, you mentioned the widgets that you're still using them. I'm not. I haven't used Dashboard in many, many years. But it was really one of those features that were so cool back in the day when they came out, and it really set macOS apart from Windows. Where, for example, I remember when I was in high school, I had my first Mac laptop, and it was running Tiger, and it had the Dashboard. And I was showing some people, like, you know, you can go to like the local public transport website, and you can just drag a rectangle, and you can open that in the dashboard, and you can have like your little widget there to check when the tram is coming, right? And that was like, it was almost like magic. It was like you made your own app in like 30 seconds, you know. It was really, really cool. And I must say, I really like the widget metaphor in general. The problem is kind of how to fit it into the operating system as a whole. For example, on iOS, I would argue that a lot of the widgets, they're kind of hidden, you know? They're hidden in the Today view, or they're hidden like in 3D Touch, which, you know, I almost never use, except by accident. So if they would be more prominent, for example, on Android, where widgets are a lot more prominent and you can have these more on your home screen, you can choose to like say this row of apps, I don't want to have a row of apps here. I want to have like a now playing bar from Spotify or something. Those kind of things could be really useful, but at the same time, they're kind of taking up permanent space if they're not living in something like a dashboard, which seems kind of from a kind of aesthetics point of view to be an additional complication. So it is tricky how to fit it in, but when you can, I think having these like more small little utilities that you can invoke from anywhere, it's a really cool thing, both from a user point of view to be able to quickly check things, but also from a kind of system architecture point of view. If you can make a lot of apps have these more thin, lightweight services, like we've talked about before, and invoke them from anywhere, you can build a very modular system. And I think this is really cool.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think we're going to get the widgets in the home screen, as you mentioned, with iOS 13. I think they are doing a big redesign of Springboard, which might even change names next year. I think we are going to get the widgets finally, which is something I think people have been asking since iPhone OS 1.
Yeah, exactly. And if we end up getting these more miniature apps as widgets on the Mac, I don't think they will be Apple Watch apps, because I don't think Apple Watch apps will really be a thing going forward. And what I mean by that is that I think what Apple is moving towards more and more is just to have one platform. You know, you can call that iOS, you can call it Apple OS, but just one tech stack that just runs through all the different devices, and the different screen sizes and the different form factors, they're just like renderers of that operating system. So then you would build your app, and if you would build it in a way where it can run on an Apple Watch, then it could probably also run as a little widget on the Mac using Marzipan, right? So I think this could happen, but not in the form of an Apple Watch app, but rather just as a piece of UI that can be invoked from anywhere on any Apple platform.
Yeah, and we are probably going to get complications on iPhone and iPad as well, which would be really cool.
Yeah, that'll be amazing. All right, our next question comes from Bas the developer. And Bas the developer, of course, asks a developer question. And that is, if we start working on a new app, what do we do before starting to write any code? That is, do we write out all the classes in detail on paper? Do we draft just a general overview of how all the classes relate to each other? Or do we just start coding right away? So basically, what kind of preparation work do you do, Rambo, before you start a new project?
As with every good question, the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
So let me give some more practical examples. Let's say I want to make an app that lets me get my list of iMessages on my Mac and export it to JSON. Let's take that as an example. Nothing to do with real life, though. just an example. I would, in that case, I would probably start with what's the most important thing about this app is I have to be able to get a list of iMessage messages and read that list from somewhere. So in those instances, I usually just go right away to the code and I implement the most important thing that I need to get working. So I just create a project or a script or a playground and I managed to read iMessage messages from the disk. Okay, so now I can start building an app around this functionality. I feel like that's a really good way to be motivated because you get some results right away. So that's a good strategy. And sometimes, like, especially when you are rethinking something that already exists, in those cases, I usually go to design. So in the case of the version 2.0 of Chibi Studio, I fired up Sketch and started to draw how I would like the app to be. Because we mentioned before, I'm a very UX-focused developer. I'm sure there are other developers who are more nerdy, and not that I'm not, and they like to do like data modeling and stuff. I usually don't do that. I do the design for the user experience, and then I code in a way to make that happen. So that's how I usually do things. I rarely draw architectural diagrams. I do it sometimes, usually when I'm trying to understand a problem better, but it's very rare for me to do that. Maybe I should be doing that more. So yeah, like the story of Chibi Studio, when we first got the idea to make the app, I remember I was running the beta version of El Capitan, I think. I don't remember which OS version it was. And I just like created a struct that would be a chibi and a struct that would be the each item, so hair, eyes, and stuff. Uh-huh. And I created an enum for the types of items, so like hair, eyes, and those things. And then I just like wrote a renderer that would take some assets and transform them into car animation. And in like an hour, I had an app that had a grid of little characters that I had hard coded into like, oh, hair number one, eyes number two. So that's how it got started. I think if I had to answer this quickly, I'd say I just go straight to code. That's how I usually do things.
But it sounds like you're doing a lot what I would call prototyping, right? You're prototyping a lot and you're doing many different iterations. And for me, that is a very, very important step. Like when people say I start coding right away, usually the way I interpret that is like you start writing your production code, right? You have a problem that you want to solve and you start writing it as the code you're going to ship. And for me, I do a lot of what you did as well, which is I do a lot of prototyping, and that can take many different shapes and forms. I can draw things out on paper, how I want them to work. For example, if I'm designing an algorithm or something, I might just draw that like in a mind map or on paper or something like that. I also can code, like for example, the syntax highlighter I've been working on. It started out as a prototype because I didn't know, like I mentioned earlier, whether I was going to be able to do this in a good way or not, like, or it would be like a too big of a problem. So I want to prove it to myself by writing a prototype. And when I'm prototyping, I'm also usually trying out many different solutions to the same problem to find like the one that I think is the best fit. And in order to do that, I basically treat my code as throwaway. Like, this code I'm not going to ship. For example, now in the syntax highlighter that I am shipping as part of the open source project, there's zero code in there that was part of the original prototype. Like, the original prototype I've completely thrown away. It was working, it was doing almost the same result, but I rewrote it as production code because I don't want to constrain myself when I'm prototyping to writing like perfect code that I want to show people or that I want to ship to the app store or something like that. So a lot of prototyping. And the thing that Baus is also mentioning in terms of like drawing out the classes and doing architectural work, I do that quite a lot too. I use mind maps for that. I use an awesome app called MindNode, where you can just like create mind maps and you can create the different relationships between objects. And again, it depends on the task. But if I'm designing, for example, the database layer, I'm definitely doing that to be able to see the different relationships visually before I start coding. Otherwise, I always end up making the wrong decisions in code and I have to refactor and change things later. And I would rather do that first, like visually see that. So that's general my approach. I did a talk this summer about prototyping in Barcelona. We'll put a link to it in the show notes, where I talked a lot about how I do prototyping and how I create these prototypes that I called MVPs, minimum viable prototypes. So it's not minimum viable product, but minimum viable prototypes. So yeah, I use prototyping a lot. That's my go-to kind of first step for any kind of project.
I just opened the folder for Chibi Studio here, and I opened the Chibi entity .swift file, and it was created by me on July 8th, 2016.
Wow. It's had its second birthday.
Yeah, this was from the prototype. So this is the one that was originally in that prototype I mentioned, and it ended up being a part of Cuteness Core.
Yeah, the best framework name ever.
Best core.
Best core. All right, that's all that we have for this episode. We're approaching the fall. There's going to be probably some new spelunking going on, Rambo. What do you think? There might be some new GMs coming sometime soon. Who knows, right? And you might be able to figure something out from them.
There might be some 2018 fall things going on.
There might be something like that, right? So we have a lot of things lined up for the fall. We're really excited about it. But for now, this is it. And you can find everything about this show at stacktracepodcast.fm. You can find our Patreon at patreon.com/stacktracepod. You can find me on Twitter and Mastodon at John Sundell. And you can find Mr. Rambo on Twitter and Mastodon as well at _inside. You are at _inside on Mastodon as well, right?
Yeah. On micro.blog, I'm just Guy.
Right. On micro.blog, I'm also at John Sundell. I'm at John Sundell everywhere. Just make it simple, right?
Yeah. You are reinforcing your brand.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm doing. All right. But that's it for now. So say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.